New York, New York, Saturday, 11:08 p.m. The large C-130 was parked and idling on the airstrip outside the Marine Air Terminal at LaGuardia Airport. 11 strikers and General Mike Rogers stood on the dark landing strip surrounded by a dozen military police. Paul Hood was taut with rage when he saw them. En route, Deputy Chief Mahaly had told Hood that the MPs had choppered in from Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, where they were attached to the Air Mobility Command. According to the information I was given, Mahaly had explained, the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee refused to give your strikers permission to become involved in the crisis. Apparently, the CIOC chairman was concerned about strikers' reputation for rule-bending, so he contacted the White House and spoke directly with the president. Obviously, Hood thought bitterly, no one had bothered to consider strikers' reputation for success. When the president tried to phone Mike Rogers, Mahaly went on, he was furious to learn a striker was already airborne. The president's next call was to Colonel Kenneth Morningside, Fort Monmouth Post Commander. I'm not surprised they're taking such a hard line. Any incursion has to be requested by the Secretary General in writing and the parameters approved by the unit's commanding officer. Hearing this, Hood was more afraid for Harley and the other children than he was before. If Stryker wasn't allowed to save them, who could? But Hood's feelings of despair shaded to rage when he saw Mike Rogers, Brett August, and the rest of the Strykers being detained. These men and women, these combat heroes, didn't deserve to be treated like thugs. Hood got out of the car and jogged toward the group. Mahaly hurried after him. Lieutenant Solo, the military police brigade commander, walked forward to meet them. Mahaly caught up to Hood and introduced himself to the colonel. Then he went to introduce Hood. But Hood had already walked past the officers. Hood stopped just short of shouldering his way through the MPs.
Mike, are you all right?
The general shrugged.
Been in worse spots.
That was true, Hood had to admit. Perspective joined common sense and Hood relaxed slightly. Lieutenant Solo said,
Mr. Hood, we've been instructed to make certain that all Stryker personnel are put back on board the C-130 and to remain at our post until the aircraft returns to Andrews.
Hood was disgusted.
Fine. Let Washington bench the only hope the UN's got. But I do have a situation that requires the presence of my second-in-command, General Rogers. The general is not a member of the Stryker unit.
Lieutenant Solo looked from Hood to Rogers, then back to Hood.
If that's true, then my instructions do not pertain to the general.
Rogers stepped away from the strikers and moved through the tight circle of MPs. Mahaly scowled.
Hold on. The general order I was given does pertain to all security and military personnel, including General Rogers. Mr. Hood, I'd like to know what the situation is that requires the general's presence.
It's personal.
If it pertains to the situation at the United Nations,
it does.
My daughter is being held hostage there. Mike Rogers is her godfather.
It didn't matter whether the Department of State security officer believed him. All that mattered was that Rogers be allowed to go with him. Mahaly looked at Hood.
Only immediate family are allowed to go into the waiting room with you.
Then I will not go to the waiting room.
He'd had enough of this. He had never hit a man, but if this functionary didn't step aside, Hood was going to push him aside. But Mahaly yielded.
All right, Mr. Hood. I'm not going to hold your feet to the fire on this one.
Mahaly looked at Rogers.
Would you like a ride, sir?
Rogers smiled.
I would, thank you.
Hood suddenly felt like he did when they used to sit in his office at Op Center. He felt reconnected, tapped into a network of devoted friends and co-workers. God help him. In the midst of everything, he felt whole again. Before leaving, Rogers turned to the strikers. They came to attention. Colonel August saluted him. Rogers saluted back. Then, on August's command, the strikers returned to the C-130. The circle of MPs parted to let them through. The police remained on the landing strip as Hood, Rogers, and Mahaly returned to the car. Paul Hood didn't have a plan. He didn't imagine that Mike Rogers had one either. Whatever Rogers might have been thinking of doing would have involved Stryker. But as the State Department sedan turned from the Marine Air Terminal and the towering C-130, Hood was slightly less anguished than he had been before. There were only two of them, but they'd think of something. They had to. New York, New York, Saturday, 11:28 p.m. Georgiev was standing near the opening of the circular table in the Security Council chamber. The other men were still guarding the doors.
When 2 minutes remained until the next deadline, the Bulgarian turned and nodded at Downer, who started down the stairs. Several of the men and women sitting on the floor inside the table began to whimper. Georgiev hated weakness, so he raised his automatic and pointed it at one of the women. He used to do that with his girls in Cambodia. Whenever one or more of them came and threatened to expose him because she was being treated poorly or was being paid less than he'd promised, Georgiev wouldn't say a word. He'd simply point a gun at her head. It never failed. Every opening in her face, her eyes, nose, and mouth, would open large and freeze there. Then Georgiev would speak.
"If you complain to me again, I will kill you," he'd say. "If you try to leave, I will kill you and your family."
They never complained after that. Out of the more than 100 girls who had worked for him during the year his ring operated, he'd only had to shoot 2 of them. Everyone on the floor stopped sobbing. Georgiev lowered the gun. There were still tears, but no more sounds. Downer was nearly at the bottom of the stairs when Georgiev saw the light on the TACSAT phone flash. He was surprised. He had spoken to Annabel Hampton an hour ago when she let him know that the Secretary General intended to try and negotiate. For a moment, Georgiev wondered if Downer's fears were going to be realized and security forces would try to move in. But that wasn't possible. The UN wouldn't risk it. He walked to the phone. Annabel Hampton had been Georgiev's riskiest but most important acquisition. From the time they had first met in Cambodia, Annabel had impressed him as a determined and independent woman. She was in Phnom Penh recruiting human intelligence and personnel for the CIA. Georgiev provided her with intelligence his girls obtained from their customers. He also gave her intel he picked up from his own Khmer Rouge contacts. When the UNTAC operation ended in 1993, Georgiev sought Annabel out in order to sell her the names of the girls he'd been using. Learning she'd been transferred to Seoul, he contacted her there. Annabel seemed more angry than ambitious by then. When he mentioned that he was leaving the army to go into business, she half-joked that he should keep her in mind if he heard of any interesting opportunities. He did. Up until this afternoon, when Annabel gave Georgiev the detailed timetable for tonight's United Nations event, he wondered if she were going to back out. He was confident she wouldn't betray him because he knew where her parents lived. He'd made a point of sending them flowers while Annabel was visiting there for Christmas. Annabel had not backed down. She had as much steel in her as any soldier in this room. He picked up the phone. "Speak," he said. That was the only word Annabel had been told to respond to.
"The Secretary General is on her way again," Annie informed him. "Only this time she's planning to come into the Security Council chamber. She hopes you'll take her in. Either that or she hopes you'll target her instead of the Italian delegate."
Georgiev smiled.
"Pacifists always hope you'll target them until you really do. Then they cry and beg. What are her advisors saying?"
"Colonel Mott and one of the Undersecretary Generals are encouraging a strike as soon as they get video images of the chamber. The other officials have been noncommittal." Georgiev glanced at Barone. The security unit wouldn't be getting any images. When Annabel had informed them of the plan, Georgiev had sent Barone to the spot where they were said to be drilling. As soon as the tiny camera came through, he would cover it.
"Was there any further discussion about paying the ransom?"
"None," Annie said.
"No matter. No video images, more dead. They'll turn to our needs soon."
"There is one thing more. I've just been informed by my superior that a SWAT team from the National Crisis Management Center is coming up from Washington."
"Sanctioned by whom?"
"No one. They're going to use my office as their headquarters. If the UN gives them the go-ahead, they may come in." That was unexpected. Georgiev had heard that the National Crisis Management Center staged a very creditable action in Russia during the coup attempt over a year before. Though he had poison gas and battle plans for the Security Council chamber, he didn't want to have to use either. On the other hand, if he could get Chatterjee in here, she would give Georgiev the means of forestalling that. Georgiev thanked Annabel and hung up. The Secretary General would be a welcome addition to the hostages. Downer arrived. The only question was what to do about the Italian delegate. If they shot him, it would undermine the Secretary General's credibility as a peacemaker. If they spared him, they'd seem weak. Deciding that the Secretary General's credibility was not his concern, Georgiev nodded to Downer. Then he watched as the Australian half-pushed, half-pulled the weeping delegate up the stairs.
They're going to do it again.
Brown-haired Laura Sabia was sitting on Harley Hood's left. She was shaking worse than before. Harley placed her fingertips back on the girl's hand to try to calm her. Barbara Mathis, who was sitting on Harley's right, was watching the terrorists. The raven-haired violinist was sitting up straight and seemed very intense. Harley knew the look. Barbara was the kind of musician who got irrationally angry if someone made a noise that caused her to break concentration. Barbara looked like she was getting to that point now. Harley hoped not. The girls watched as the masked men led the delegate up the stairs. The victim fell to his hands and knees on one of the steps and was crying, saying something fast and high in Italian. The masked man, the Australian, grabbed him by the back of his collar and yanked at him hard. The Italian struggled back to his feet. Near the young violinists, in the center of the circular table, a delegate's wife was comforting another woman. Harley guessed that this was the wife of the man who was about to die. Laura was literally fluttering now, as though there were an electric current running through her. Harley closed her fingers around Laura's hands and squeezed.
You've got to calm down.
I can't, Laura said. I can't breathe. I need to get out of here.
Harley squeezed her hand harder.
Soon, they'll get us out. Just sit back and shut your eyes. Try and relax.
The two men had reached the top of the stairs. Suddenly, Laura shot from her seat. Harley was still holding the girl's hand.
Why are you doing this to us? Laura shrieked. I want you to stop it now.
Harley tugged gently on her hand.
Laura, don't do this.
The leader of the gang was standing halfway up the steps. He turned and glared at the girls. Miss Dorn was sitting three seats away. She rose slowly but remained behind her seat, then spoke firmly.
Laura, sit down.
No!
Laura pulled away from Harley.
I can't stay here.
She screamed and ran around the table. She was headed toward the door on the other side of the chamber, the door the leader had been guarding. The leader started down the stairs as Laura ran across the carpeted floor. Miss Dorn ran after Laura, shouting for her to come back. The man who'd been standing on the other side of the room guarding the other door left his post and ran after the teacher. The Australian man at the top of the stairs had stopped and was looking down at them. Everyone was watching Laura as the leader, Ms. Dorn, and the other man all reached the door. The other man grabbed Ms. Dorn around the waist, pulled her back, swung her around, and literally flung her to the floor. The leader reached the door as Laura was pulling it open. He threw his shoulder into it, closing it, and pushed Laura back. The girl stumbled, fell, got up, and rushed toward the stairs. She was still shrieking.
The door isn't locked.
The thought hit Harley like a bright light. Of course it wasn't locked. The men didn't have the keys to lock the doors, including the door no one was guarding. The leader was running after Laura. Ms. Dorn had had the wind knocked from her, but was fighting with the man who'd thrown her down. The pressure must have gotten to her. The music teacher wasn't thinking. But Harley was, clearly and confidently. She was thinking not only of getting out and saving herself, but of bringing what Uncle Bob Herbert called intel to the outside. The teenager turned slowly and stole a sidewards glance at the door. She could run a dash like that easily. She'd blue-ribboned the 50-yard dash in high school 2 out of 4 years. Harley used the toe of her right high-heeled shoe to slip off her left shoe. Then she slowly did the same with the right. Her fellow students were watching the struggle. Harley eased the chair back.
Don't do it,
Barbara said from the side of her mouth.
What?
Harley said. Barbara barely spoke above a whisper.
I know what you're thinking because I'm thinking the same thing. Don't go for it. I am. I'm faster than you. I beat you 2 years in a row.
Barbara's eyes were angry and her mind was made up. Harley didn't know what to do. She didn't want to race Barbara for the door. They'd only trip each other up. The girls looked over as the leader caught Laura midway up the stairs. He lifted her off the floor and threw her backwards down the stairs. Laura bounced and rolled and came to a stop at the bottom. The leader hurried down to her. Barbara took a few slow, shallow breaths. She put her hands on the edge of the wooden table. She waited until she was sure that no one was looking her way. Then she pushed off from the table, rose, and ran. Her legs were hindered by the tight gown she was wearing. Harley heard a rip along the side, but Barbara kept running. Her arms churned, and she ignored whichever of the terrorists or delegates or whoever was shouting at her to stop. Harley watched as she reached the door.
Go, Harley thought.
Barbara stopped to pull it open. Harley heard the latch click, the door came open, and then she heard a whip-loud crack. The next thing Harley knew, Barbara was no longer standing. She was still holding the doorknob, but she was on her knees. Her hand slipped from the knob and her arm flopped to her side. Barbara's body remained upright, but only for a moment. Then she fell to the side. She was no longer angry. Secretary General Chatterjee stopped when she heard the muffled gunshot. It was followed by shrill cries, and then a few moments later there was a second gunshot, closer to the corridor than the first. Almost immediately after that, the door of the Security Council chamber opened. Ambassador Contini was thrown out, and the door was quickly shut. Colonel Mott ran over to the body at once. He looked behind the head. There was a single wound, just like before. As the medical team ran up and placed the body on a stretcher, Chatterjee walked toward the doors of the Security Council chamber. Mott intercepted her.
Ma'am, there's nothing you can gain by going in there now. At least wait until we have the video.
Wait? I've already waited too long.
Just then, one of the security force personnel came from the Economic and Social Council chamber. Lieutenant David Mailman was assigned to a makeshift two-person reconnaissance team. He and his partner had pulled a 15-year-old remote infinity eavesdropping device out of storage. Designed to work over a telephone line, they rigged it to pick up voices through the headphones of the translating units at each seat in the Security Council chamber. Lieutenant Mailman spoke to the colonel.
Sir, we think someone just tried to get out of the Security Council. We saw the doorknob twist. Whoever was back there moaned after the report.
The lieutenant looked down.
It didn't sound like a man, sir. It was a very soft voice.
Chatterjee was horrified.
One of the children.
We don't know that, Mott said. Mailman left. The colonel balled his fists, then looked at his watch. He was waiting for word about the video surveillance. Secure phones had been requested from the U.S. State Department diplomatic security forces. Until they arrived, all communications had to be done person to person. Chatterjee had never seen a man look so helpless. A child may have been shot, she thought, then started toward the door. Mott gently grabbed her arm.
Please don't do this. Not yet.
The Secretary General stopped.
There is nothing I can do from the outside. If it becomes necessary to take action, you won't need me here. But inside, I may be able to make a difference.
The colonel looked at the Secretary General for a long moment, then released her arm. She smiled softly.
You see? Diplomacy. I didn't have to pull my arm away.
Mott seemed unconvinced as he watched her go. Paul Hood and Mike Rogers sat in the back seat of the sedan while Mahaly sat up front with his driver. The car was approaching Manhattan. Mahaly said,
Where will I be dropping you off, Mr. Hood? General Rogers?
We'll get out where you do, Hood said.
I'm getting off at the State Department.
That'll be fine.
Hood said nothing more. He still intended to go to the CIA shell at the United Nations Plaza, though he didn't want Mahaly to know that. The car emerged from the tunnel on 37th Street. As the driver made his way up First Avenue, Mahaly turned to Mike Rogers and said,
I want you to know I hate what happened back there. I've heard about Stryker. They got quite a rep. Far as I'm concerned, we couldn't do much better than to send your people in and get this thing over with.
Mahaly answered the phone as the car stopped at the 42nd Street barricade. Hood looked over at the United Nations complex. From this angle, looking up, the Secretariat building seemed large and imposing against the black sky. His baby seemed so small and vulnerable as he thought about her inside that blue-white monstrosity. Mahaly hung up.
Another delegate was shot, and possibly, one of the children.
Hood stared at him. It took an instant for one of the children to translate as possibly Harley. When it did, life seemed to lose all forward momentum. Hood knew that he would never forget Mahaly's somber expression at that moment, the brilliant white glare on the windshield and the looming Secretariat behind it. It was now and forever the picture of lost hope. Mahaly said,
There's been no communication from the Security Council, but the Secretary General is going to try and get inside.
The sedan pulled up to the curb and Hood said,
Mike, I've got to go to Sharon.
Rogers cracked the door and stepped out.
I know.
Mahaly handed Hood his business card.
Let me know if you need anything.
Thanks, I will. Mahaly once again looked like he wanted to ask something, but didn't. Rogers shut the door. The car pulled from the curb and Rogers stood facing Hood.
Paul, I'm going across the street. Brett is going to meet me at the shell.
Hood was surprised. Brett August had been among the men detained at the airport.
But Rogers said, "We saw the MPs when we were taxiing to the terminal. We had a pretty good idea why they were there. Brett told me he'd get out somehow and meet me here." The general found a little smile. "You know Brett, no one tells him to run." Hood looked over at the State Department tower. "I've got to go to Sharon. You have my cell phone number?" Rogers nodded. "I do. When we find something out or have any ideas, I'll call." Hood thanked him and started toward the red brick building. Georgiev was carrying the panicked Laura back to her seat when Barbara Mathis went down. Downer, who had fired the shot, was running from the top of the gallery. Georgiev continued toward the circular table. He wondered if that whole thing had been planned. One girl runs screaming to get everyone's attention while another girl runs in the opposite direction and tries to get out. If so, it was a clever, dangerous maneuver. Georgiev admired courage. But just like some of the girls who used to work for him in Cambodia, some of whom were no older than this girl, she had acted disobediently, and she had to be punished. Suddenly, two delegates stood up. Georgiev dropped the stunned Laura into her seat where she sat sobbing. He ordered the other delegates to sit down.
"But that girl is hurt," one of the delegates said. "She needs help."
Georgiev raised his gun.
"I haven't selected the next one to die. Don't make my choice easy."
The men sat down. The one who'd spoken looked like he wanted to say something else. His wife urged him to be silent. The other one looked sadly toward Barbara. To their right, Contini's wife was sobbing hysterically. One of the other wives was hugging her tight to keep her from wailing. Van Dahl brought the music teacher back and ordered her to sit as well. Miss Dorn said that she was responsible for Barbara and insisted that she be allowed to take care of her. Van Dahl pushed her back down. She started to get back up. Angrily, Georgiev swung toward the woman. He pointed his gun at her head and walked forward.
"One more word from you or anyone else and they will die," he said through his teeth. "One more word."
Georgiev watched as the woman's nose flared and eyes widened, just like the horrors in Cambodia. Reluctantly, she sat down and turned her attention to the girl who'd tried to run. Van Dahl returned to his post. Downer reached Georgiev's side at the same time as Barone. Barone got very close to the Australian.
"Are you insane?"
Barone snarled.
"I had to do it." "Had to?"
Barone said, careful to keep his voice low.
"We were going to try not to hurt the children."
But Downer was determined that he'd done the right thing.
"The mission would have been in jeopardy if she'd gotten away. You heard me yelling, saw me running toward her. I would have gotten to her before she reached the outer door."
"Maybe yes, maybe no," Georgiev said. "The important thing is she didn't get away. Now go back to your posts, both of you. We'll take care of her here as best we can. You should be watching for the fiber optic cable. Or would you rather see our planning and effort lost because of that?"
He pointed toward Barbara. Downer grunted and returned to the top of the gallery. Barone shook his head in frustration and went back to the front of the gallery. Georgiev watched them go. Whether he liked it or not, this had changed things. Crime is a mood-intensifying effort. Close quarters heighten emotions, and an unexpected drama makes things even worse.
"You have to let me send her out of here."
Georgiev turned. An Asian woman was standing beside him. He hadn't even heard her.
"No,"
he said. He was distracted. He had to refocus, get his men back, push the United Nations harder, and he thought he knew how.
"But she's going to bleed to death,"
the woman said. Georgiev walked toward one of the duffel bags. He didn't want the girl to die because it might incite a rebellion among the hostages. He pulled a small blue case from inside and came back. He handed the woman the box. She frowned.
"A first aid kit? That isn't going to help."
"That's all I can give you."
"But there may be internal bleeding, organ damage."
Downer waved and caught Georgiev's eye. The Australian was pointing toward the door.
"You'll have to make do."
The Bulgarian dismissed the woman and motioned Van Dahl over. When the Frenchman arrived, Georgiev told him to make sure the Asian woman didn't try to get out. Then Georgiev walked toward the stairs. He stepped up to Downer.
"What is it?"
"She's here,"
Downer said.
"The Secretary General. She knocked on the bloody door and asked to come in."
Georgiev looked past the Australian. Focus, he told himself. If he let Chatterjee in, her efforts would become focused on getting the girl medical attention, not on getting them the money. And if he did let the girl out, the press would find out that a child had been hurt, possibly killed.
There would be increased pressure for military action despite the risks for the hostages. There was also the chance that the girl might become conscious in the hospital. If she did, she could describe the distribution of the men and hostages to security personnel. Of course, Georgiev could let the Secretary General in and refuse to let the girl out. What would Chatterjee do? Risk the lives of the other children by refusing to cooperate? She might, Georgiev thought, and just having her challenge his authority in here might embolden the captives or else weaken his influence among his own people. Then it came to him, suddenly, like his best ideas always did, a way to give Chatterjee what she wanted without compromising his demands. He would see her, only not in the way she expected. Hood felt lonely and scared as he rode the elevator to the 7th floor lounge of the State Department. That was where the other parents were waiting. If he weren't certain that security cameras were watching him and that he'd end up getting hauled away as a menace, Hood would have screamed and thrown uppercuts at the air. He was deeply worried about the rumors of a shooting in the Security Council, and he was miserable being on the sidelines. The elevator door opened, and as Hood stepped toward the security desk, his cell phone beeped. He stopped walking and turned his back on the guard before answering.
Yes? Paul, it's Bob. Is Mike with you?
Hood knew Herbert's voice very well. The intelligence chief was talking fast, which meant that he was worried about something.
Mike went to see that local office manager you told him about. Why?
Hood knew that Herbert would have to speak obliquely, since this was a potentially open line.
Because there are two people in the target zone that he needs to know about, Herbert replied. Heavy-duty rappers.
People with rap sheets, a long history of no good. This was maddening. Paul had to know more. Herbert said,
Their presence and the timing could be a coincidence, but I don't want to risk it. I'll call Mike at the other office.
Hood walked back to the elevator, pushed the button, and said,
I'll be there when you do. What's the name?
Doyle Shipping. As the elevator arrived, Hood folded up the phone and stepped inside. Sharon would never forgive him for this. Never. And he wouldn't blame her. She was not only among strangers, but he was certain the State Department wasn't telling the parents anything. But if the terrorists had associates on the inside that no one else knew about, he wanted to be on hand to help Rogers and August think things through. At least he would have something to focus on other than fear. Not hope, but something almost as good. An offensive. It was him. The flat voice, the cruel eyes, the arrogant carriage. It was him, damn his soul. Tai Soka couldn't believe that after nearly 10 years, she and her husband Hong had found Ivan Georgiev, the man who'd forced Hong's little sister into prostitution in Cambodia, then killed her when she'd tried to escape. Now that Tai had heard his voice beneath the mask, been close enough to smell his sweat, she knew which of these monsters it was. Several months before, an arms dealer named Ustinovics, who provided the Khmer Rouge with weapons, had been asked to talk to Georgiev about a buy. An informant with the Khmer Rouge knew that Tai and Sari Hung, Cambodian freedom fighters, were looking for him. The informant sold them the name of the arms dealer. Though they had missed the Bulgarian when he came to New York to talk to Ustinovics the first time, they managed to get to Ustinovics after Georgiev had gone. The offer they made the Russian was simple. Let them know when he was coming to pick up his weapons, or they would turn Ustinovics over to the American FBI. The Russian had let them know when Georgiev was scheduled to pick up his purchase, with the provision that they didn't take him at that time. They agreed. As it happened, they didn't want him then. They wanted him doing whatever it was he'd come here for. When the rest of the world could see. When they could draw attention to their own people. Put an end to the countless murders in which they'd taken part as they tried to stop the Khmer Rouge and undermine the pathetically weak government of Norodom Sihanouk. They'd watched Georgiev's team make their buy from the roof of the club next door to the shop owned by Ustinovics. After Georgiev and his people made their arms purchase, Tai and Hong followed them back to their hotel. The adjoining rooms had been booked, so they took the room beneath theirs. They ran a wire through the ceiling fixture to the floor of his room, attached a sound amplifier, and listened as Georgiev and his allies reviewed their plans. Then they'd gone to the permanent mission of the Kingdom of Cambodia across the street and waited. Tai Soka turned her large dark eyes from the stricken young girl lying beside her, the one who was barely older than Fum had been when she'd been murdered by one of Georgiev's thugs. Tai looked over at Sari Hung, who was sitting on the floor inside the circular table. The Cambodian operative had shifted his position slightly so that he could see Tai without seeming to watch her. She nodded. He nodded back.
When Georgiev came back down the stairs, it would be time. Georgiev stopped when he reached the double doors at the back of the Security Council chamber. Reynold Downer was standing to the right of the doors. He had a weapon in either hand.
Are you going to let her in?
Downer asked. Georgiev shook his head.
No. I'm going out there.
Georgiev could see that Downer was surprised, even through his mask.
They'll take you hostage.
The Secretary General spoke again. She asked to be admitted.
They wouldn't take the chance. This will convince them they have no choice but to cooperate, and quickly.
Downer shook his head.
I don't agree with this. I bloody don't.
You wouldn't, Georgiev thought. Downer only knew how to bully, not how to finesse. Slowly, Georgiev reached for the knob on the left side door. He turned and pushed the door open a crack. Mala Chatterjee was standing there, her arms straight at her sides, her shoulders and head back. Behind her, several paces, was her head of security. Beyond him, Georgiev could see a few of the security guards with their blast shields. Chatterjee spoke first.
I'd like to speak with you. Tell everyone to step back, past the council chambers.
Chatterjee turned and nodded to Colonel Mott. Mott motioned for the rest of the security team to step away. They did. Mott remained where he was.
Everyone, Georgiev said. Go, please,
Chatterjee said firmly. Mott turned and joined his security team. He stood nearly 30 feet away, glaring at Georgiev. That was good, Georgiev thought. She had just emasculated her chief of security. The colonel now looked like he wanted to draw his gun and put a bullet in Georgiev. The Bulgarian opened the door further. Shields rose slightly as arms tensed behind them. Georgiev holstered his weapon and stepped through the open door. Facing the security team, he shut the door behind him. Slowly, fearlessly. They knew who had more courage and who was more at ease. Coming out here was the right thing to do. He looked at Chatterjee.
What do you want?
I want to resolve the situation without further bloodshed.
He spoke evenly.
You can. Just give us what we asked. I'm trying, but the nations have refused to pay. Then someone else must pay. Let the United States rescue the world again. I can talk to them, but it will take time.
Georgiev shrugged.
You can have it. The price is one life every hour.
No, please. I would like to suggest something. A moratorium. I'll have a better chance of getting what you ask if I can tell them you're cooperating. But it will take hours, maybe days.
Georgiev shrugged again.
Then the blood is on your hands, not on mine.
Chatterjee looked down. She'd never had to deal with anything like this before. He almost felt sorry for her. What does a diplomat do when you keep saying no?
I give you my word, she said. Stop the killing. I will get you everything you want.
You will get it for me anyway.
Georgiev turned toward the door. He reached for the doorknob. Chatterjee moved after him.
Don't do this. Don't you understand? No one will benefit from this.
She grabbed his arm in desperation. Georgiev stopped and wrenched his arm toward him. The woman held on.
Listen to me,
she implored. The big man threw his arm back. Chatterjee fell against the wall that stood out just beyond the door. Georgiev turned back toward the door. There were footsteps behind him. Georgiev reached for his automatic and turned just as an elbow came swinging across his line of vision. His vision swirled red. The bridge of his nose and his forehead were numb, and he was lightheaded. He was fighting to stay. A second blow turned everything black. Mike Rogers spoke urgently to Paul Hood.
Something just happened.
Rogers was sitting at the computer with Annie Hampton. Hood had arrived moments before. Annie had put the bug's audio on the computer speakers. Even though the sound was being recorded, Rogers didn't want to miss a word of the very faint conversation between the Secretary General and the terrorist. Annie seemed extremely intent on what was happening.
"We think something just happened outside the Security Council," Rogers told Hood. "One of the terrorists came out to talk with the Secretary General. From the sound of things, she shouted, and then someone, probably Colonel Mott of the UN security team, who we believe was closest to her, apparently attacked the terrorist. It sounds like they have him, but we can't be certain. Everyone is being very quiet."
They listened silently for a moment more. Then Hood spoke.
"This may not have anything to do with what's going on, but I just got a call from Bob. There are two people inside the Security Council who spent at least 8 years with the Cambodian Khmer People's National Liberation Armed Forces. They started as counter-terrorists fighting the Khmer Rouge and then became assassins working for Son Sann."
Annie fired him a look as he continued.
"They came into the country 2 days ago with the permission of someone in their government, though their backgrounds were intentionally obscured. The question is, are they there by chance? Are they working with the terrorists, or is something else going on that we don't know about?"
Roger shook his head as there was another buzz at the door. Annie put the surveillance image on the computer. It was Brett August. Rogers got up and left the office to show him the way up. Colonel August was sweaty and grease-stained. He saluted Rogers, then explained that he'd done a pencil roll from the C-130's hydraulically operated cargo ramp while it was no one saw him as he rolled tight and low down the ramp. He was wearing a Kevlar bulletproof vest under his sweatshirt, and that had taken some of the impact. Because August was a fully equipped tourist, he'd had his wallet with him and enough cash for the cab ride to Manhattan. Rogers brought him up to date as they walked to Annie's office. As they neared, August stopped suddenly.
"Hold on. Did you know that your lady here worked for the CIA in Cambodia?"
Rogers was openly surprised.
"No. Tell me about it." "I downloaded her file on the flight over. She recruited operatives in Cambodia for nearly a year."
Rogers let his mind run through various scenarios, looking for possible connections.
"She signed in downstairs about 15 minutes before the attack began. She said she'd come here to catch up on some work. But she got here early, and she has the ability to eavesdrop on the Secretary General. She also has a TACSAT phone in the office."
August looked thoughtful.
"Not standard CIA office issue."
Rogers agreed.
"Nope. Sounds like a nice setup if you want to pass intel to people who were involved in this takeover."
"But which side of the takeover?"
"I don't know," Rogers said.
They continued toward the office. Neither man was an alarmist, but from the start of their careers, with anywhere from one life to thousands of lives hanging on any decision they made, neither man had ever been complacent. And as Rogers turned into the office, he reminded himself of something that the CIA had learned the hard way, that volatility didn't always come from the outside. For a moment, the silence in the corridor outside the Security Council was absolute. Then Secretary General Chatterjee pushed herself off the wall where she'd been flung. She looked from the prone terrorist to Colonel Mott, then whispered harshly,
"You had no right to do that."
"You were attacked," he whispered back. "It's my job to protect you."
"I grabbed him."
"It doesn't matter."
Mott pointed to two of the men on the security line and motioned them forward. Then he turned back to Chatterjee.
"We're in this now."
"Against my wishes."
"Mom, we can discuss this later. We don't have much time."
The two men arrived. Mott pointed to the terrorist.
"Strip him, fast."
"What are you doing?"
The colonel began unbuttoning his own shirt.
"Going in there is him."
Chatterjee seemed stunned.
"No, absolutely not. Not without my authority."
"I don't need your authority. The fiber optic camera is not getting through for some reason. We're coming up on another hour and a child may be hurt in there. Help me end this situation, Mom."
"Did he have an accent?"
Chatterjee seemed dazed.
"Eastern European, I believe."
One of Mott's men removed Georgiev's mask.
"Do you recognize him?"
Chatterjee looked at the beefy, unshaven face. There was blood on the thick bridge of his nose.
"No."
The colonel motioned for his man to give him the mask. He pulled it over his head, then stooped and wiped some of the blood from Georgiev's nose onto the mouth of the mask.
"Now I don't have to do any accent."
Chatterjee watched as he quickly finished pulling on the man's sweater, trousers, and shoes. The colonel spoke to his second-in-command, Lieutenant Mailman.
"Get everyone into the trusteeship council chambers. I want you at the adjoining doors, fast but stealthy. Form two groups, a defensive perimeter and a team to get the hostages out. Go in when you hear gunfire.
Mott picked up Georgiev's automatic and checked the clip. It was nearly full.
I won't fire until I'm in position to take out one or more of the terrorists. I'll try and stay on the north side to draw their fire away from you. You know how they're dressed. Take them out.
Colonel, I'm against this. You're risking the lives of everyone in the room.
Mott spoke quickly.
Everyone in there is going to die unless we get them out. Isn't that what this person told you?
He indicated Georgiev with his foot.
I can still go in there. Try and talk to the others.
Not after this. They'll want to know where their man is. What will you tell them?
The truth. It might persuade them to cooperate. Perhaps we can even give him back in exchange for hostages.
We can't. We may need him for information, and whatever else happens, this bastard's got to stand trial.
Mott had always admired Chatterjee's persistence. Right now, though, it seemed more naive than visionary. The colonel signaled over the emergency medical team. They placed the fallen terrorist on a stretcher and used handcuffs from one of the security officers to keep him there.
Take him over to the infirmary and keep him handcuffed to the cot,
Mott told the head emergency medical technician. The lieutenant signaled Mott that he was ready to go. Colonel Mott signaled back 30 with his fingers. He looked at his watch as Lieutenant Mailman's two teams headed into the trusteeship council chamber. Then he started marking off 30 seconds. Chatterjee was almost pleading now.
Colonel, please, I can't go in if you do. This is a mistake.
There was a creak at the security council door as though someone had leaned against it. Chatterjee immediately fell silent. Mott looked from the door to Chatterjee to his watch. 20 seconds remained. Mott spoke quietly.
It's only a mistake if it fails. Now please, Madam Secretary General, there's no time to debate this. Just step back so you won't be hurt.
Colonel,
she started, then stopped, then started again.
God be with you. God be with you all.
Mott thanked her. There were 15 seconds to go. Reluctantly, Chatterjee backed away. Colonel Mott suddenly thought of one of the original Mercury astronauts, he forgot which one, who said, as he waited to be launched into space, "Dear God, please don't let me screw this up." 5 seconds. Alert and ready, Mott walked toward the door of the Security Council. He moaned as though he'd been hit and was hurting. He yanked open the door and stepped inside. Tai Soka continued to squat beside the gravely wounded girl on the floor. There was nothing more she could do for her, but then she hadn't come here to save lives. Taking care of the girl had done one thing and one thing only. It had enabled her to establish which of these men was Ivan Georgiev, which of them owned the voice she had heard in the UN camp as it ushered customers in and out of tents, which of them had ordered his aide to pursue and shoot Fum when she tried to escape. Tai had a compact 9mm Browning high-power handgun in her purse. Hung had one in a holster hooked to the back of his belt. Between the two of them, they'd get the bastard in a crossfire and then take down the rest of the terrorists. Not only would they have their revenge, not only would they be seen as heroes for rescuing the hostages, but their cause, a strong right-wing Cambodia, would acquire worldwide attention. Cambodia would be free to become an Asian political and financial power. But all of that depended on what happened next. Tai opened her purse and removed a silk handkerchief. She left her purse open on the floor as she dabbed the forehead of the wounded girl. The butt of the Browning was pointing toward her. When she replaced the handkerchief, she took the opportunity to unlock the safety. She was getting anxious. She hoped the miserable creature didn't negotiate a deal with Secretary General Chatterjee. Tai grew quietly furious with herself for not having taken him out when she had the chance. She might have died, but she would have died knowing how proud Hung and the spirits of his family were with her. Suddenly, one of the double doors flew open at the top of the stairs on the opposite side of the chamber. Georgiev stormed back in. The Bulgarian was holding the lower part of his mask. He slammed the door shut, drew his pistol, and shook it angrily at the door. Then he turned and stalked past his associate. When the other man tried to follow, Georgiev motioned for him to remain where he was. Then he half-walked, half-stumbled down the stairs. He seemed a little groggy, as though he'd been struck. He did not look happy. That was good. According to the doctrine of the elders in the Theravada Buddhist faith, a man who died unhappy remained so in the next life. Tai felt that Georgiev deserved no less. The Bulgarian stopped midway down the stairs and rubbed his chin. He seemed to waver. The man at the top of the steps came toward him. So did one of the men at the bottom of the steps.
Damn, Ty thought. It had to be now. Soon there would be three of them in one place. She might not have a clear shot.
She looked at Hung. He was obviously thinking the same thing. She reached into her purse as Hung rose. He drew his weapon from the holster and turned toward his target. Ty slipped her own handgun free and followed his lead. Hung fired first, putting three shots into Georgiev before the others arrived. One bullet missed, but two red blotches popped from his forehead, and the Bulgarian was flung back first against the wall. He slid straight to the ground, dragging three long red smears down the green and gold wallpaper. The couple began running forward, seeking cover on the stairwell. The two other men on the stairs stopped, ducked behind the chairs, and swung their guns toward the shootists. The two terrorists on the other side of the chamber also ducked and aimed at the attackers. As they did, the door that led to the trusteeship council chamber opened. Four members of the United Nations Security Force rushed in. There was a heart-stopping moment when the only sounds were the sobbing of children. The two Cambodians turned to see who was behind them, and the terrorists paused to aim at the nearest targets. The distraction enabled the terrorists beside Georgiev along the south wall to fire at Tai and Hung. The Cambodians went down. Hung took a bullet in the shoulder, Tai in the thigh. Hung's cry was cut short by a headshot that dropped him flat on the floor. Tai had lost her handgun when she fell and was reaching for it when a second shot caught her in the upper arm and a third struck her in the belly. She reached for her abdomen, stopping suddenly when a fourth shot cracked through the top of her skull. It took slightly more than a second for the Cambodians to fall and die, but their presence had confused the UN police, who weren't sure whether to fire at them or not. The delay enabled the terrorists on the north side of the chamber to turn, aim, and fire straight down the stairs at the door. One security officer went down, shot through the leg, and had to be pulled out. The other three who had entered squatted and returned fire to cover their withdrawal. Noticing the wounded girl, one of the security men grabbed her under the arms and dragged her back. One of the terrorists on the southern side of the chamber went down. A UN security officer was shot in the face and simply fell over. The room was an echo chamber of thundercrack shots and screams. The firefight ended when the UN forces withdrew and the door to the trusteeship council chamber crashed shut. The gunshots stopped, but not the screaming, nor the sense of madness that, for a few deadly seconds, seemed to infect everyone in the chamber. Ronald Downer laid Georgiev's bloody body down while Etienne Van Dahl knelt over him.
You better go back to the door, Van Dahl said. They may try to come in again.
Downer pulled his blood-red gloves from under Georgiev and looked across the room. The smaller of the two other terrorists was running down the stairs. That meant Sazanka had taken the hit. Downer watched as Barone bent over him. The Uruguayan stood and dragged a finger across his throat. Their pilot was dead. Downer swore. So did Van Dahl. Downer looked down. Van Dahl had removed Georgiev's mask. Only it wasn't Georgiev who was lying on the landing. Downer couldn't believe it.
They've got him. I thought I heard a noise out there. The bastards have got him.
He spit on the face that lay lifeless on the carpet. Van Dahl looked down at the bodies lying near the gallery.
Who was those other two? Probably undercover police working security for the party. Then why didn't they move sooner, try and save the delegates? Maybe they sent some kind of silent signal for reinforcements and they were just waiting,
Downer said.
I don't think so. They almost seemed surprised when they saw the United Nations team come in.
Downer went back up the stairs and Van Dahl turned and hurried down the steps. He was worried about the doors, though he didn't really think there would be another attack now. The UN forces had gotten hurt. They took away the wounded girl, but he didn't think that was their objective. They came in looking like they wanted to establish a beachhead. The firefight had put the hostages low on the floor or sent them ducking under the table. There was a lot of sobbing and whimpering, but everyone had been rattled by the attack. No one was going anywhere. Barone had come over. He nodded toward Georgiev.
Is he dead? It isn't him. They got him when he went out. Made a switch.
Barone was amazed.
Who would have thought they had the cojones? If he gives them information about the bank accounts, then even if we get out of here with the money, they'll take it right back.
Van Dahl thought out loud.
We still have what they want. We still have the means to kill the hostages if the security forces come in again. So I suggest we stick to our plan with two differences. We tell them we want cash, and we speed up the clock.
His eyes settled on Harley Hood. There was something about her, something defiant, that hit him wrong. He told Barone to get her.
The audio bug in the corridor picked up the shots from the Security Council chamber. The reports were muffled, as were the shouts in the corridor, but it was clear to Paul Hood and the others that one side or the other had made a move. The shouts continued after the gunfire had stopped. Rogers had asked for and was given a book of blueprints of the United Nations. On the floor near where Rogers had pulled his chair was an upright canvas case. The zippered bag was open on top, and Hood could see a TACSAT phone inside. As Hood stood there listening, he heard his cell phone beep. He assumed it was Bob Herbert or Ann Ferris with information. Hood slipped the phone from his pocket.
Hello?
Paul, it's me.
Sharon?
Christ, not now, he thought, turning his back to the room.
I'm sorry, hon. I was on my way up to see you when something happened. Something that had to do with Mike.
He's here?
Yes.
He wasn't really listening to the phone. He was trying to hear what was happening in the Secretariat building.
Are you holding up okay?
Paul asked her.
You've got to be kidding.
Sharon sounded desperate.
Paul, I need you.
I know. Look, we're in the middle of something here. We're trying to get Harley and the others out. Can I call you back?
Sure, Paul, just like always.
Sharon hung up. Hood felt like he'd been slapped. How could two people be so close one night, then be totally unconnected the next day? But he didn't feel guilty. He felt angry. He was doing this to try and save Harley. Sharon wasn't happy being alone, but that wasn't what the hang-up was about. It was about the fact that Op Center had separated them again. Hood folded his phone and put it away. Mike placed a hand on Hood's shoulder. Suddenly, they heard Chatterjee's voice clearly.
Lieutenant Mailman, what happened?
Another voice said,
Someone shot Colonel Mott before the rest of the team went in. He may be dead. They killed one of my people, and then we got one of the terrorists before withdrawing. We also pulled a girl out. She'd been shot. There was no way we could get in without taking a lot of casualties.
Hood felt his knees weaken.
I'll find out who it is, Rogers said. Don't call Sharon. You may worry her for nothing.
Rogers went to the office phone and called Bob Herbert. In order to keep track of known terrorists and underworld figures, many of whom were regularly hurt in explosions, car accidents, or gunfights, Op Center had a program that was connected with all the big city hospitals and interfaced with the Social Security Administration. Whenever a Social Security number was entered on a hospital computer, it was checked against Op Center's database to make sure that the person wasn't someone the FBI or police were looking for. In this case, Herbert would have Matt Stoll check on everyone who was admitted to a UN-area New York hospital in the last half hour. The conversation continued in the Secretariat. The lieutenant said,
There's something else. Two of the delegates were armed and firing. One of the team members who got a good look said it was an Asian man and woman. They were both killed by the terrorists. Believe it or not, they were firing at Colonel Mott. They must have mistaken him for the terrorist he replaced.
A radio beeped. Chatterjee answered it.
This is Secretary General Chatterjee.
That was stupid and reckless.
The man's voice was scratchy and faint and spoken with an accent, but Hood was able to make out most of what was being said. Concentrating on that was a welcome distraction from thinking about the wounded girl.
I'm sorry for what happened. We tried to reason with your partner.
Don't try and make this our fault, the caller snapped.
No, it was all mine.
You knew the rules and you ignored them. Now we have new instructions for you.
First tell me, what is the condition of our officer?
He's dead.
Are you sure?
There was a shot.
Now I am. Do you have any other questions?
No.
Good. You can come and get him when we're gone. How soon that happens is up to you.
Chatterjee kept her voice even.
I'm listening.
We want the helicopter with $6 million. We want cash, not transfers. You have our man. He may tell you our names. I don't want our accounts frozen. Let us know when the helicopter is here. We will resume the killing in 8 minutes and again every half hour. Only this time we won't be killing delegates. We'll continue on the young ladies.
Hood realized he had never known hate until that instant.
Oh, please, no,
Chatterjee cried. The caller's voice dripped with scorn.
You made this happen.
Listen to me. We'll get what you want, but there must be no more killing. There has been too much already.
You have 8 minutes.
All was quiet. Hood could imagine the depth of the Secretary General's frustration. August shook his head.
The troops ought to go back in now. Hit them fast when they don't expect it.
We ought to go in, Hood said.
They said they'll release poison gas, Annie told him.
But they didn't during the first assault, August said. Hostage takers want to live. That's why they've got hostages. They won't give up that advantage.
Rogers turned from the phone. It wasn't Harley who was shot. The girl's name is Barbara Mathis. Everything was relative. Harley was still a prisoner, and one of her ensemble mates was injured, yet relief washed over Hood from the inside out. Despite the fact that Harley was still in there, Hood had to agree with August. The men in the Security Council chambers were not suicide bombers or political terrorists. They were pirates, here for plunder. They wanted to get out alive. After a moment, Chatterjee informed the lieutenant that she was going to the infirmary. She wanted to talk to the captured terrorist. There was no further audio after the Secretary General left. Annie told them that she was out of range of the bug. Rogers looked at his watch.
We've got less than 7 minutes. What can we do to stop them?
He looked at Annie.
You've been listening to this for nearly 5 hours. What do you think?
She shrugged. I don't know. They're leaderless. There's no telling what they might do now. Hood frowned.
How do you know that? That they're leaderless?
She shrugged again.
Who else would have gone out to talk for them?
The phone rang and Annie picked it up. It was Daryl McCaskey for Rogers. Annie passed him the phone. Something else passed between Rogers and the woman as well. A disapproving look. Or was it doubt? The conversation was short. When he was finished, Rogers said,
UN Security fingerprinted the captured terrorist. Daryl just got the intel.
Rogers looked back at Annie. He leaned over her chair, his hands on the armrests.
Talk to me, Ms. Hampton. The terrorist's name is Colonel Ivan Georgiev. He served with UNTAC in Cambodia. He also worked with the CIA in Bulgaria. Did you ever hear of him?
No.
But you know something about this that we don't.
No.
You're lying.
Mike, what's going on? Hood asked.
She came to the office before the attack, Rogers said. He moved closer to Annie.
To work, you said?
That's right. You're not dressed for work.
I was stood up. That's why I came here. I had reservations at Chez Eugenie. You can check.
Hey, I don't know why I have to defend myself to you.
Because you're lying, Rogers said.
You knew something was going to happen. You served in Cambodia. Colonel Mott was killed by a pair of Cambodians posing as delegates to the United Nations. Did they think they were shooting Ivan Georgiev?
How the hell should I know? Rogers shoved her chair back. It rolled across the tile floor and slammed into a filing cabinet. Annie started to rise, and Rogers pushed her back down. Hood shouted, Mike! But Rogers was unstoppable.
We don't have time for this bullshit, Paul. Your daughter could be the next one they kill.
He glared down at Annie.
Your tax ad is on. Who are you calling?
My superior.
Call him now.
Annie didn't move.
Who's on the other end of that line? Was it the Cambodians or is it the terrorists?
Annie said nothing. Her hands were on the armrests. Rogers slapped one of his hands on top of hers. He pushed a thumb under her index finger and bent it back. She screamed and reached over with her other hand to try and pry him off. He used his free hand to shove her hand back on the armrest and kept up his pressure on the other.
Who's on the other end of the goddamn phone?
I told you! Rogers bent the finger back until the nail was nearly touching the wrist. Annie screamed.
Who's on the other end?
The terrorists! Annie cried. It's the terrorists! Hood felt sick as Rogers kept questioning her.
Are there any other outside units besides you?
No!
What are you supposed to do next?
Tell them if the money's really being delivered. Rogers released her hand. He rose. Hood was staring at the young woman.
How could you help them? How?
We don't have time for that now, Rogers said.
They're going to kill someone else in 3 minutes. The question is, how do we stop them?
By paying them, August said. Rogers looked at him.
Explain.
We get Chatterjee's number from Op Center. We ask her to get on the radio to tell the terrorists she has the money. Then our lady here corroborates that. We contact the NYPD, get a chopper over there like they asked for, and have a SWAT unit take them when they come out.
They'll come out, but with hostages, Hood said.
We're going to have to risk the hostages at some point. At least this way we'll save more than we could in the Security Council, and one of them for sure. Hood glanced at his watch.
Do it. Fast.
Secretary General Chatterjee raced down the escalator to the infirmary, which was located on the first floor not far from the visitor's lobby.
An aide had joined her at the foot of the escalator and was walking with her. Chatterjee passed through the delegates-only doorway near the Hiroshima exhibit and made her way along the brightly lighted corridors. She tried not to think of the loss of Colonel Mott or the other security personnel, or of the deaths of the delegates. She focused on the impending death of one of the young violinists and how to avoid it. Chatterjee had it in mind to offer Georgiev a deal. If he would urge his accomplice to postpone the shooting and help to defuse the situation, she would do what she could to get him clemency. They turned a corner and approached the door to the infirmary. Chatterjee walked in. She stopped abruptly. Two EMTs were lying on the floor in the reception area. The attending nurse was also lying on the floor in the doctor's office. So were a pair of security guards. There were no tears in their clothes, no indication that there had been a struggle. There was no trace of the handcuffs, and no sign of Georgiev. As Chatterjee took a moment to process what had happened, there was only one conclusion to be drawn: that someone had been here waiting. Hood called Bob Herbert and got Chatterjee's mobile phone number. After binding Annie Hampton to a chair, Rogers took the key case from her blazer. CIA regulations require that whoever was in charge of a shell have access to the self-defense materiel. Rogers found the key that unlocked the rack and took a pair of Berettas for himself and another pair for August. He also grabbed a pair of point-to-point radios along with a brick of C4 and detonators. He hoped he didn't need any of these, but he wanted to be prepared for the worst. Rogers looked down at Annie.
If you cooperate, I'll help you when we get out of here.
She didn't respond.
Do you understand? Rogers pressed. I understand, she said without looking up.
After handing August his guns, Rogers took the colonel's arm. He led him to where Hood was standing, still holding the phone.
What's wrong? August asked. I don't have a good feeling about our prisoner, Rogers said quietly. Why? Hood asked. In a few minutes, she's going to have us by the short hairs. Suppose Chatterjee calls the terrorists for us. Then this woman refuses to back up the lie. Where are we then?
I'd say pretty much where we are now, August told him.
Not exactly, Rogers said. The terrorists will have been attacked and then lied to. They're going to want to hit back. Shoot a hostage as scheduled and add another as payback.
Are you saying we shouldn't do this? Hood asked.
No, I don't think we have a choice, Rogers said, because if nothing else, we can buy ourselves a few extra minutes.
For what? Hood asked.
To take control of this situation, Rogers said. To launch a bottleneck operation.
August seemed pleased. Rogers described his plan to Hood. Hood didn't like the odds, but they were running out of time. He okayed Rogers' plan, and August left at once. Hood punched in Chatterjee's number. He glanced at his watch. Assuming the terrorists didn't rush the deadline, there was just over a minute left. A woman came on the line.
This is Mala Chatterjee.
Madam Secretary General, this is Paul Hood. I'm the director of a crisis management team in Washington. One of the hostages is my daughter.
Yes, Mr. Hood?
I need your help. I need you to radio the terrorists and tell them that you have the money and the helicopter they've asked for. If you do that, we can make sure they believe you.
But we don't have those things, Chatterjee told him. Nor are we likely to.
By the time the terrorists figure that out, they'll be outside the building, Hood said. I'll have the NYPD ready to get them there.
We've already tried one very costly attack. I won't authorize another.
This will be different. If the terrorists are outside, they can't control all the hostages. We can get some of them away, and if they use poison gas, we'll be in a better position to help the victims. But you've got to call the terrorists now. You've also got to tell them that the offer is only good if they don't kill any more hostages.
Chatterjee hesitated. Hood couldn't understand what she was hesitating about. After the hit the security forces had just taken, there was only one answer. I'll do it. I'll help save a life and smoke the bastards out.
Madam Secretary General, please. We have less than a minute.
All right, the Secretary General replied. I will place the call to save a life.
Thank you, Hood replied. I'll be in touch.
Harley Hood was on her knees, facing the closed doors of the Security Council chamber. The Australian man was standing behind her, holding her hair tightly, painfully. The other man, the Spanish-sounding man, was behind him, looking at his watch. Harley's face was badly swollen above the right cheek where she'd been pistol-whipped when she tried to bite him. There was blood on her mouth where she'd been back-fisted hard. Her gown was torn at both shoulders, her neck rug-burned from being dragged up here, and her left side hurt with every breath because she'd been jackbooted there just a few seconds before. She had not gone willingly to her execution. Harley screamed a cry of rage that came from deep inside. She screamed again, and then her bruised muscles exploded, and she tried to get to her feet. The Australian tugged hard on her hair, twisting her around. Harley fell to the ground, onto her back. Her captor dropped his knee onto her chest, hard, and remained there. He put the barrel of his gun in her mouth.
"Scream into this," he said.
Harley did, defiantly, and he pushed the barrel down her throat until she gagged.
"Go on, one more time, Angel," he said. "Scream again, and it will scream back."
Metallic-tasting saliva quickly pooled in the bottom of Harley's throat. Blood mixed with the saliva, and she stopped screaming.
"It's time," Barone said.
Downer glared down as Harley made a guttural sound around the gun barrel. Just then the radio beeped.
"Hold it,"
Barone said quickly. He answered the radio.
"Yes." "This is Secretary General Chatterjee," said the caller. "We have your money, and a helicopter is on the way."
Downer and Barone exchanged looks. Barone hit the mute button. His eyes narrowed suspiciously.
"She's lying," Downer said. "She couldn't have gotten it this fast."
Barone disengaged the mute.
"I'll execute two hostages if you're lying,"
he said. He punched the radio off and hurried to the TACSAT phone at the front of the Security Council chamber. While they waited for the TACSAT phone to ring, Rogers made a call. To check messages, he said. That wasn't true, but he didn't want the young woman to know it. He wanted to borrow Hood's cell phone to make the call. While Hood looked on, Rogers stood between the woman and the desk so she couldn't see what he was doing. It was a trick he had learned from Bob Herbert, who used his wheelchair phone to spy on people after he left a meeting. Rogers turned off the ringer on the office phone, then called the number using Hood's cell phone. He answered the office phone, switched to speaker, and left both lines open. Then he put the cell phone in his pants pocket, making sure he didn't disconnect. Rogers went back and sat on the desk across from Annabelle Hampton. Hood paced between them. As the minutes inched by, Rogers became more convinced that this wasn't going to go the way he wanted. When the TACSAT beeped, it startled them all. Hood stopped pacing and stood beside Rogers. Annabelle's gaze shifted to the general. Her mouth was set, and there wasn't a hint of compliance in her pale blue eyes. Rogers wasn't surprised.
"Answer the phone," he said.
She stared at him. Her eyes were cold.
"If I don't, are you going to torture me again?"
"I'd rather not," Rogers said.
"I know that,"
Annabelle said. She grinned.
"Things have changed, haven't they?"
"You said you'd cooperate," Hood pointed out.
"And if I don't cooperate, what will you do? If you shoot me, the hostage dies for sure, possibly your daughter."
Hood's body stiffened. She was better than he'd expected, Rogers thought.
"What do you want?"
he asked.
"I want you to cut me loose and leave the room," she said. "I'll make the call you want, then I go free."
"I won't do it," Rogers said.
"Why not?" Annie asked. "Don't want to dirty your hands cutting a deal with me?"
"I've cut deals with worse than you. I won't cut a deal because I don't trust you." The TACSAT phone beeped a second time.
"Whether you trust me or not, if I don't answer the phone, they're going to assume that something has happened to me. They'll execute the girl."
"In that case," Rogers replied evenly, "you'll either be executed or spend your life in jail as an accomplice."
"Miss Hampton, please," Hood said. "It's not too late to help yourself and dozens of innocent people."
The TACSAT beeped a third time.
"There will be a total of 5 rings," Annabelle said. "Then a girl in the Security Council chamber will have her head blown open. Let me go, and I'll tell them what you want."
"Why don't you say what we want, and then we'll let you go?" Rogers countered.
"Because as much as you don't trust me, I don't trust you. And right now, you need me more than I need you."
The TACSAT beeped a fourth time.
"Mike," Hood said.
"I'm against this," Rogers said to Annabelle.
The general tucked a gun into his belt, reached into his pants pocket, and pulled out a switchblade. He snapped it open with a flick of his hand and began cutting her free. The taxat beeped a fifth time.
"I want you out of here," Annabelle said. "I want to see you on my security camera in the hallway. And leave me my keys."
Rogers took the key case from his pants pocket and tossed it on the floor in front of her. Then he grabbed his jacket from the back of a chair and followed Hood out. As soon as Rogers and Hood passed beyond the fisheye lens of the security camera, Rogers took Hood's cell phone from his pocket. The general stopped in the corridor and listened, then disconnected. He handed Hood the cell phone along with one of his two guns.
"She told him the truth?" Hood asked.
"She screwed us good," Rogers said.
Colonel Brett August moved like a leopard through the silent park outside the UN. There were no helicopters positioned over this sector. Their lights were all on the UN and its immediate approaches. Save for the spillover from the spotlights around the UN complex, the grounds were dark. August's stride was long and sure, his body bent low, his balance perfect. The high stakes energized rather than daunted him. Despite the fact that nothing was ever guaranteed in combat, he was confident. Confident of his training, his abilities, and the necessity of what he was doing. He was also confident of the plan. And thinking ahead, he realized he had several things on his side. He had been trained as a soldier, not as a security guard. The seats in the Security Council would offer him cover. Thanks to the long, open staircases, the terrorists would find it difficult to sneak up on him, especially if he kept moving low through the upper tiers. And if the terrorists tried to use hostages as a shield, the Stryker leader had two other advantages. One was his eye. Brett August was one of the deadliest shots in the combined special forces, and he had the medals to prove it. Only Mike Rogers had one more. The other advantage was that August wouldn't be afraid to fire. If he had to risk killing a hostage to take out a terrorist, he was prepared to do that. As Mike Rogers had said earlier, if they didn't act decisively and soon, the hostages were going to die anyway. He had shifted to a confrontational mindset when his focus was on the goal and not the means. And he had only one goal, to win. The Secretary General was still standing in the corridor outside the Security Council. Little had changed since the siege began. Security personnel were more agitated than before, especially those who had taken part in the aborted assault. Young Lieutenant Mailman was the most restless of all. There were sounds from behind the door of the Security Council. Whimpering, knocking, snarls. Something was happening. A moment later, Paul Hood called.
"One of my men is on the way up. He's dressed in civilian clothes."
"No," the Secretary General said.
"Madam Secretary, you've got to let us handle this. You don't have a plan. We do."
Chatterjee cut him off.
"No, Mr. Hood."
She felt like screaming. The phone beeped again. She shut it off and handed it to her assistant and told him to leave. It was as though someone had spun the world like a top. She was dizzy, electrified, and exhausted at the same time. Chatterjee looked at the Security Council door. She would have to try and go in again. What else was there to do? Just then, there was a commotion from the hallway just past the Economic and Social Council chambers. Several of the delegates turned around, and the members of the security force were going over to see what was happening. Lieutenant Mailman ran over to the police line. He arrived just as the barefoot Colonel August shouldered through the crowd of delegates. August raised both hands to show the security people that he was unarmed, but he didn't stop moving. Mailman's voice was an insistent whisper.
"Let him through."
The line of blue shirts parted immediately, and August stepped through. As he did, he reached into his pants pockets and withdrew two Berettas. He was less than 10 feet from the door. All that stood between him and the Security Council chamber was Mala Chatterjee. The Secretary General looked at August's face as he neared. His eyes reminded her of a tiger she'd once seen in the wild in India. This man had smelled his prey, and nothing was going to come between them. At the moment, those eyes seemed like the only steady thing in her universe. This wasn't how it was supposed to be. Leon Trotsky had once written that violence seemed to be the shortest distance between two points. The Secretary General didn't want to believe that. When she was a student at the University of Delhi, Professor Sandhya A. Panda, an acolyte of Mohandas Gandhi, had taught pacifism as though it were a religion. Chatterjee had practiced that faith devoutly. Yet in 5 hours, everything that could go wrong did. Her best efforts,
her self-sacrifice, her calm thoughts. At least Colonel Mott's aborted attempt had managed to get a wounded girl to the hospital. Just then, there was a soft cry from the other side of the door. It was a girl's voice, high and muffled.
No, don't!
Chatterjee choked on an involuntary cry of her own. She turned reflexively to go to the girl, but August stopped her with a firm nudge as he rushed past. Armed with a handgun, Lieutenant Mailman followed August. He stopped several paces behind the colonel. Chatterjee started after them. Mailman turned and held her back. Chatterjee didn't have the energy or will to resist. In a madhouse, only the insane are at home. The American paused at the door, but only for a moment. He turned the handle with the heel of his left hand. A heartbeat later, he followed both guns in. Shortly after answering the TACSAT call from Barone, Annabelle Hampton went to the closet, took one of the last remaining Berettas, and walked into the hallway. The corridor was empty. The bastards who had tried to bully her were gone. She headed toward the stairwell. Annabelle didn't want to take the elevator for two reasons. First, there were security cameras built into the ceiling. Second, the men from Op Center might be waiting for her in the lobby. She wanted to take the stairs to the cellar and slip out the side door. She would reconnect with Georgiev later, as planned. She had sent the two CIA floaters to pick him up at the UN infirmary. The door opened in. There were no windows, so the young woman opened it cautiously in case anyone was on the other side. No one was waiting there. Annabelle let the door shut and started down the steps. And then the lights went off. Annabelle considered going back, but she didn't want to waste the time or risk a showdown with whoever had cut the lights. Switching the gun to her left hand, she grabbed the handrail with her right hand and made her way down slowly. She reached the landing, turned the corner, and started down the second half of the stairs. She was pleased with the progress she was making. Until a bright light snapped on in front of her, and then a sharp, crippling pain struck her left thigh. She fell over, unable to breathe and losing the gun as pain rocked her entire left side.
"Put him back on!" someone shouted.
The stairwell light snapped back and Annabelle looked up. She saw a beefy, black-haired man looming over her. The name tag on his shirt said Deputy Chief Bill Mahaly. Mahaly picked up her gun and tucked it in his waistband. Annabelle tried to get up but couldn't. She could barely breathe. As she lay there, she heard the door open on the fourth floor landing. Hood ran down the stairs. He must have been the one who turned off the lights. Hood stopped on the landing and looked down at the young woman. His expression seemed sad.
"I thought we had a deal," she gasped.
"So did I," Hood replied. "But I know what you did. I heard."
"My team will take it from here," Mahaly said to Hood. "Thanks for your help."
Hood stepped back. Shaking his head, he turned and ran down the stairs. Without quite being able to wrap her brain around the idea, Annabelle knew that she was probably going to spend the rest of her life in prison. As disturbing as that was, however, what bothered her most was the fact that Paul Hood had outsmarted her. That once again, a man had come between her and her goal. Colonel August stood in the Security Council doorway, simultaneously looking for the killer and making himself the target. He was wearing his bulletproof vest and was willing to trade hits if it would save a hostage's life. The terrorist couldn't shoot a hostage if he was shooting at August. The first person August saw was a slender teenage girl. She was on her knees less than 5 yards away. She was whimpering and shaking. August wasn't sure who the girl was. The terrorist was standing very close behind her. Using peripheral vision, August noted the location of the other two terrorists. One of them was standing in the front of the Security Council chamber behind the semicircular desk. The other terrorist was standing right beside the door that led to the adjoining trusteeship council. The terrorists were all dressed in black and wearing ski masks. The one nearest him was holding the girl's long blonde hair by the roots, close to her forehead, so that her face was staring straight up. He had a gun pointed directly ahead at the top of her skull. August had the middle of the man's mask in his gun sight, but he didn't want to fire first. If he hit the terrorist, the man's finger might tighten around the trigger and take the top of the girl's head off. August knew that was wrong. If he had the shot, he should take it. The thought that this could be Paul Hood's daughter stopped him. The terrorist hesitated, and then he did something that surprised August. He dropped directly behind the kneeling girl and then threw himself to his right into the row of seats. Still holding the girl's hair, he pulled her with him. Obviously, he did not want to trade gunfire. and now he had a shield.
You should have taken the damn shot, August reprimanded himself.
The terrorist and the girl were four rows down the sloping gallery. August pocketed the Beretta that was in his right hand, turned to his left, and jogged a few feet along the back of the gallery. Silent in his bare feet, he leaped the green velvet seats and immediately jumped the next row. He was now two rows from the terrorist and the girl. One of the others shouted,
"Down there, he's coming for you! Behind you!"
The pinned terrorist shouted at August,
"Get out or I'll kill her! I'll blow her goddamn brains out!"
August was still two rows away. The man with the French accent started running toward him. The third man was covering the hostages.
"Barones, I guess!"
The third terrorist, Barone, ran toward a duffel bag that sat open in the front of the chamber near the north side window. August finished hopping over the third row. He could now see Downer and the girl. They were on the floor of the next row. The terrorist was on his back with the girl face up on top of him. But August had a problem. He had to reorder his priorities. He had to deal with the gas. Barone had removed his ski mask and had pulled three gas masks from the duffel bag. The terrorist slipped one of the masks on as he handed the others out. The other men didn't put them on yet because the goggles impaired their peripheral vision. Then Barone returned to the bag and removed a black canister. August turned and ran toward the north side of the chamber. The French terrorist had reached the stairs on the south side of the Security Council and was running up. August didn't want to stop and shoot it out with him. He'd be in a better position to kill Barone if he were on the same side of the chamber. The table and the tightly huddled hostages were still in August's way. He reached the stairwell and started down. The Frenchman was directly across the room. The terrorist suddenly stopped and fired several rounds. Two of the four shots hit August in the waist and ribs. The impact threw him against the wall, though the bulletproof vest stopped the slugs.
"You're down, you bastard! Down here, cover me!"
He cut through one of the middle rows of the gallery, heading toward the north side. The Australian threw the girl aside and stood. He screamed in raw, frustrated rage. Pulling himself off the wall, August continued crawling down the steps. He ignored the sharp pain in his side. Where he was, behind the seats, the Frenchman did not have a shot at him, and Barone was almost in view. Just then, a loud crack broke from the back of the room. From the corner of his eye, August saw the Frenchman fall forward between the rows. Downer ducked fast as Lieutenant Mailman crouched behind his gun in the open door and shouted,
"Keep going, sir!"
Good man, August thought. Mailman had shot at the Frenchman, though August couldn't tell whether or not the terrorist had been hit. August reached the bottom step as Barone carefully peeled a red plastic strip from the canister's mouth. He threw the tape aside and began unscrewing the cap. August fired twice. Both bullets punched holes in the side of Barone's head, spilling him toward the front of the chamber. The canister fell to the carpet, a thin wisp of green vapor slipping around the neck of the container. August swore. He got to his feet and ran toward the door that adjoined the trusteeship council. He had it in mind to get to the canister and shut it. He never made it. The Frenchman emerged on the north side of the gallery. He was unhurt and opened fire. This time he aimed at August's legs. August felt two sharp bites, one in his left thigh and one in his right shin. He went down, the wounds burning fiercely. August ground his teeth together and crawled forward. Pain management training had taught him to set small, attainable goals. He concentrated on where he needed to be. Behind him, Downer fired at Mailman, driving him back outside the door. Meanwhile, the Frenchman crept down several steps. The canister was just a few feet from August. The cap was still on, but the gas was beginning to spread. He needed to screw it back on. He didn't have time to turn and fire. Suddenly, there was a massive pop about 10 feet in front of him. The great brown drapes on the northernmost window blew open and bulletproof glass flew straight across the front of the Security Council. A moment later, right on schedule, Mike Rogers stepped into the room. Mike Rogers looked across the Security Council chamber and saw Colonel August roughly 4 yards in front of him. The colonel was on his knees and bleeding from both legs. Between them was a dead terrorist and a container leaking gas. Rogers also saw the armed terrorist in the north side gallery stairwell. Obviously, something had gone terribly wrong. Firing two shots to drive the terrorist gunman back between the seats, Rogers turned and grabbed the drape. The blast had torn it in the middle, and yanking hard, he ripped the bottom half from the window. Many kinds of poison gas were lethal if they came into contact with the flesh. He would rather try to contain the gas this way than close the canister. Rogers pulled the heavy fabric over the container. He figured that should buy them about 5 minutes in here. Enough time to get everyone out. he'd have them leave through the broken window. As Rogers turned to the girls who were gathered around the table, August swung onto his back and sat up. He was still holding one of his Berettas.
All right, Rogers said. I want all of you to go out through the window, quickly.
Led by Ms. Dorn, the girls hurried toward the outside terrace and safety. As they did, Rogers turned back to August.
Where's the third terrorist?
Fourth row from the top of the gallery, August said. He's holding one of the girls.
Rogers swore. He hadn't seen Harley Hood among the girls down here. It had to be her. As August spoke, he had maneuvered onto his knees and crept back toward the stairwell. Raising himself up on the wooden banister, he started up the steps. He held his right arm out, Beretta pointed ahead. Rogers didn't have to ask him what he was doing. He was using himself as bait to draw the terrorist's attention. Rogers stood between the hostages and the gallery. Several of the delegates also rose and scrambled to get out, pushing the girls aside as they ran. If it were up to Rogers, he would have shot them. But he didn't want to turn his back on the gallery, not with one of the terrorists still up there. The drapery seemed to be holding down the gas for now. Rogers wished he could move over to the north side of the chamber to cover August, but he knew he had to look out for the safety of the hostages. He watched as August limped higher. Rogers turned for a moment to check on the girls. All of them had been evacuated, and the last of the delegates were heading toward the window. Then, as Rogers turned back, he heard a shot from the gallery. He saw August's arms fly back as the colonel lost his gun and he stumbled against a wall. A moment later, August went down, back first. Rogers swore and ran toward the stairwell. The terrorist rose and fired at the general. Since Rogers wasn't wearing a bulletproof vest, he had to drop to the floor in front of the gallery. The terrorist shouted at him,
"Don't worry, you'll get your turn."
"Give it up,"
Rogers yelled as he wriggled toward the stairway on his belly. The terrorist didn't answer, not with words. The next thing Rogers heard were two shots and then a cry. Rogers swore. "I'll kill him," he thought bitterly as he rose quickly, hoping to nail the terrorist before he could turn and aim. But Rogers was too late. He watched as the terrorist dropped his gun, twisted, and then slumped over the back of one of the seats. There were two large red exit wounds in his back. Stepping toward the stairway, Rogers saw August still lying on his back. There was a bullet hole in his left pocket. August removed the second gun from his pocket. The barrel of the gleaming Beretta was still smoking.
"Son of a bitch should have paid closer attention," August said.
Rogers was relieved, though he was far from happy as he turned toward the steep gallery. There was still a third terrorist, the one who apparently was holding Harley Hood hostage. He had been ominously silent throughout the exchange. A UN security officer was crouched in the doorway. Save for the muted hissing of the gas canister under the drapery, the chamber was quiet. And then they heard a voice from the aisle of the upper gallery.
"You have not won. All you have done is gotten more of the ransom for me."
By the time Paul Hood arrived, children and delegates were already running out through the shattered window.
"They did it," Hood thought proudly. He hoped that Rogers and August were all right.
Hood stopped and watched as the young women and delegates approached. He didn't see Harley among them, but he recognized one of her friends, Laura Sabia. He went over to her. Laura stepped out of the line.
"Mr. Hood."
Hood slid around a police officer, ran over and took the young girl's hand.
"Laura, thank God. Are you all right?"
She nodded.
"I'm okay."
"What about Harley? I don't see her."
"She's still inside."
Hood looked into the girl's bloodshot eyes. He didn't like what he saw.
"Is she hurt?" "No." Laura shook her head and started to cry. "But he has her."
"Who does?"
"The man who shot Barbara."
"One of the terrorists?"
Laura nodded. Hood didn't wait to hear any more. Releasing Laura's hand and ignoring the police officer's shout to stop, he ran toward the terrace. Harley's head rose above the back of the seats and stopped. Downer was below the seats, still holding her hair tightly. The girl's face was pale and upturned. The tip of the gun barrel was pressed to the back of her head. Mike Rogers was at the foot of the gallery in the center. The only target he had was the hostage taker's left hand. That was too close to Harley's neck, and it still left his right hand free, holding the gun. Rogers kept his gun trained on the hand, though he knew that they weren't going to be able to let this go on for very long. The drape would only contain the poison gas for another few minutes. Even if he could get to a gas mask, that wouldn't help Harley. August was crawling up the stairs on the north side of the chamber to Roger's right. Though hobbled by the gunshot wounds to his legs and clearly in pain, the colonel had no intention of sitting this out. Behind the terrorist, mailmen entered the room cautiously from the back door. Suddenly, Rogers heard a sound behind him. He turned as Hood appeared in the frame of the shattered window. Rogers motioned him back. Hood hesitated, but only for a moment. He stepped away into the darkness of the terrace. Rogers faced the gallery and turned his gun back to the terrorist, who shouted,
"Hey, hero! I'll kill the bloody girl if I have to. I'll put a hole in the back of her goddamn head."
Rogers shouted back,
"I saw you kill my partner. I believe you."
August stopped and looked at Rogers. Rogers motioned for him to stay still. August did. He was supposed to be dead. Rogers shouted again,
"What do you want us to do?" "First, I want whoever's creeping up behind me to get the hell out of here. I can see his feet from here. I can also see the window, so if anyone tries to sneak in, I'll know it. When he's gone, I want you to put your gun down and raise your hands straight up. When you're both out of here, I want you to send that bitch Secretary General in with her hands on her head."
Foolishly, Rogers tried to reason.
"You don't have a lot of time. The gas will come through." "I know about the gas. I won't need a lot of time if you shut up and move."
"All right," Rogers said.
"Lieutenant, please make sure the Secretary General is outside and then stay out of the room. I'm coming up to join you."
Mailman hesitated. Rogers aimed his gun at Mailman's forehead.
"Lieutenant, I said I want you out of here."
Mailman scowled and backed from the Security Council. Rogers squatted, put his gun on the floor, and lifted his hands high. Then he walked toward the staircase on the south side of the chamber. He quickly made his way up the stairs. He didn't think the terrorist would bother firing at him. Until Secretary General Chatterjee came in, Rogers was his only means of communicating with the outside. Rogers continued up the stairwell. He was nearly level with the fourth row from the top where the terrorist was hiding. He was looking at Harley, whose back was toward him. The slender girl was locked in place with her hair pulled tight. She wasn't crying, but that didn't surprise him. From talking to POWs, Rogers knew that pain provided focus. It was often a mercy, a distraction from danger or a seemingly hopeless situation. He wanted to say something encouraging to Harley. At the same time, he didn't want to do anything that might annoy the terrorist. Not when there was a gun barrel pressed against the girl's skull. Rogers backed out the door. That gave him one last chance to glance toward the north side of the chamber. He couldn't see Brett August from where he was standing. Either the colonel had snuggled up close to the seats, or else he'd lost so much blood from his wounds that he'd passed out. Rogers stepped into the hallway. Chatterjee was there. She put her hands on her head and started toward the door to the Security Council. Rogers put his arm in front of her, barring her way.
"You know about the poison gas?"
She paused.
"The lieutenant told me."
Rogers stepped closer and whispered,
"Did he also tell you that one of my men is still in there?"
She seemed surprised.
"The terrorist thinks my man is dead," Rogers said. "If Colonel August can get a shot, he's going to take it. I didn't want you to be surprised and give him away."
Chatterjee's expression darkened. Rogers lowered his arm and the Secretary General walked past him. As she entered the Security Council and shut the door behind her, Rogers felt like running in after her and dragging her out. He had a sick feeling deep in his belly, the feeling that despite everything that had happened, Chatterjee still believed in an unwritten United Nations policy, a policy that the World Organization had upheld repeatedly against the weight of common sense and fundamental morality, the idea that terrorists had rights.
Mala Chatterjee's mind and soul were tortured as she entered the Security Council chamber. The terrorist was lying on the floor. Chatterjee saw the head of his prisoner, and she saw the gun being held against it. She ached for the child and was repulsed by the act of terrorism. Chatterjee would do anything to save the girl. But the Secretary General was troubled by the idea of allowing a murder to take place when there might be another way. She walked down the steps toward the row.
"You asked to speak with me?" she asked.
"No, I asked you to come in,"
Downer said.
"I don't want to talk. I want out of here. I also want what I came for."
Chatterjee stopped at the foot of the aisle.
"I want to help you. Let the girl go."
"I said no more talk!"
Harley shrieked as the Australian tugged harder on her hair.
"There's poison gas leaking up front. I need you to arrange a place where the lady and I can wait while you get my money and transportation. I want the $6 million.
Chatterjee saw something move on the northern staircase. There were eyes peering over the armrest of the last seat. The man who had been left inside raised himself up slightly. He put his index finger to his lips. The Secretary General was torn. Was she about to be part of a rescue effort or an accomplice to a cold-blooded killing? This American soldier and his partner had rescued most of the hostages. Perhaps it had been necessary for them to kill, but that didn't give them the right to continue killing. Chatterjee's goal had always been to find a bloodless solution to conflict. She spoke out clearly.
"Colonel August, there has been enough killing today."
August froze. Downer looked stunned.
"Who are you talking to?"
he asked.
"Who's here?"
"Another soldier," she told him.
"Then he wasn't killed, the bastard."
Chatterjee spoke evenly.
"Please put down your weapons and leave, Colonel."
August replied bitterly.
"I can't. I've been shot." "You'll be shot again if you don't get the hell out of here,"
Downer screamed. The Australian swung Harley around roughly. He pulled her up by her hair, knelt behind her, and aimed his automatic at August. He fired a burst as the striker leader dropped back onto the stairwell. Wood from the armrests flew in every direction. Snarling, Downer looked back at Chatterjee. He kept Harley between himself and August. At the bottom of the chamber, the Secretary General could see the poison gas beginning to creep around the edges of the drape.
"Get him out!"
Downer cried.
"I'm trying to help you," Chatterjee shouted back.
"Let me handle..."
"Shut up and do what I said,"
Downer screamed. He turned to face her. For a moment, his chest was facing the front of the room. A gunshot ripped through the chamber. The bullet punched a hole in the right side of Downer's neck, away from Harley. He dropped the gun and released Harley as the impact sent his arms back. Paul Hood rose from the bottom of the Security Council chamber. He was holding the Beretta Mike Rogers had left behind and shouting,
"Get down, Harley!"
She covered her head and dropped straight down. A moment later, a second gunshot cracked from the north staircase. Colonel August put a shot cleanly through the terrorist's left cheek. A second bullet drilled through Downer's temple as he fell. Chatterjee screamed. Paul Hood dropped the gun and ran around to the north side staircase. Waved on by August, Hood continued up to his daughter's side. Outside in the hallway, Paul Hood and his daughter took a long moment to embrace. Hood was crying openly. Harley was shaking violently. Her head was on his chest and she was clutching his arms. He spoke through his tears.
"We've got to get word to your mother."
Harley nodded. Mike Rogers was standing behind them, watching as medics carried Brett August away. Rogers said he'd take care of bringing Sharon over. He also told Hood that he was proud of him. Hood and his daughter headed toward the escalators along with delegates and security personnel. As they started downstairs, he couldn't imagine what was going through Harley's mind. She was still holding him tightly and staring ahead with glazed eyes. She'd spent over 5 hours in that room watching people being shot, including one of her best friends. She had nearly been executed herself. The post-traumatic stress would be intense. Hood knew from experience that what had happened today was going to be with his daughter every moment of every day for the rest of her life. Former hostages were never truly free. They were haunted by a sense of hopeless isolation, the humiliation of being treated as a thing and not as a human being. Dignity could be rebuilt, but in an unintegrated patchwork fashion. The sum of the parts would never equal the shattered whole.
"What life puts us through," Hood thought.
But his daughter was safe in his arms. As they reached the bottom of the second elevator, Hood saw Sharon running across the lobby. If anyone had tried to keep her out, obviously they'd failed. A woman from the State Department was behind her, desperately trying to keep up, and Sharon ran, screaming, "My baby! My girl!" Harley broke away from Hood and ran to her mother. They clutched each other and wept convulsively. Rogers walked in, accompanied by Bill Mahaly. Behind them, in the courtyard, Secretary General Chatterjee was talking to reporters. She was gesturing angrily. Deputy Chief Mahaly offered Hood a powerful hand clasp.
"I want to shake your hand. You three rewrote the crisis management book today. I'm honored to have been here to see it."
Hood tried to smile.
"Thanks. How's Brett?"
Rogers said,
"He'll be okay. The bullets missed the femoral artery. The wounds caused more pain than damage."
Hood nodded. He was still looking at Chatterjee. There were spots of the terrorist's blood on her outfit, hands, and face. He said,
"She doesn't seem very happy."
Mahaly shrugged.
"We're going to hear a lot of shit about what you did here. But the hostages are safe. Four of the terrorists are taking a dirt nap, and one thing is certain. It'll be a blustery day in hell before anyone tries something like this again."
Alexander was asleep when Hood walked into the hotel room. Sharon had gone to the NYU Medical Center with Harley. In addition to a physical checkup, it was important that she talk to a psychologist as soon as possible. Harley had to understand that she did nothing to bring this on herself and shouldn't feel guilty about having survived it. Before any of the other damage could be attended to, she had to understand that. Hood stood by the side of the king-size bed and looked down at his son. The boy's life had changed. His sister's needs would be different, and he didn't even know it. The innocence of sleep. The night was starting to catch up with Hood. His legs were weak from all the running, and he'd strained his lower back when he'd run crouching into the Security Council chamber. He eased himself down beside Alexander. He kissed the boy lightly behind the ear. He hadn't done that in years and was surprised. He could still smell the remnants of little boyhood there. The peace of the child gave comfort to the man, and as he slipped into sleep, Hood's last thought was how strange it all was. He had helped to make these two children, yet by their needs and by their love, the reverse was also true. These children had created a father. New York, New York, Sunday, 7 a.m. A call from Bill Mahaly startled Hood awake. The State Department official was calling to inform Hood that his wife, daughter, and the other families were being brought to LaGuardia Airport for a flight to Washington. Mahaly said that his wife had been notified at the hospital and that the NYPD would arrive at the hotel in an hour to escort him and his son to the airport. Hood was sore and groggy, and the bright white sunshine was like an acid bath in his skull.
"Why the quick evac?"
he asked.
"It's mostly for you," Mahaly said, "though we don't want it to seem like we're hustling you out." "I don't follow. And why is the NYPD handling this instead of the State Department?" "Because the police are used to protecting newsmakers, and like it or not, you just became one. You could run for prime minister in Great Britain and Israel and probably win. Other than that, the news isn't good. The Secretary General described you as just another impatient American with a gun. She's demanding an investigation and house arrest. The rest of the world press I've seen so far has picked up that mantra. So you're being evacuated. No one in the State Department or the White House has decided how to play any of this yet. I guess they want you here to help figure it out."
The Hoods and the other families flew back to Washington, D.C. on an Air Force 737. Sharon had been very quiet during the half-hour flight. She sat with Harley beside her, the young girl's head on her shoulder. Hood had sat across the aisle watching. Like most of the young musicians, Harley had been given a mild sedative to help her sleep. Unlike most of the girls, however, her sleep was punctuated by tiny whines, shouts, and spasms. Maybe the greatest tragedy of all, Hood realized, was that he hadn't saved Harley from that damn room. The poor girl was still there in spirit, if not in body. The aircraft landed at Andrews Air Force Base, ostensibly so the military could assure the privacy of the children. But Hood knew better. Andrews was where Op Center was based. After they taxied, Hood saw Op Center's white van waiting for him on the tarmac. Lowell Coffee and Bob Herbert were both visible in the open side door. Sharon didn't see the men until she was on her way down the steps. Hood acknowledged them with a nod. The State Department had provided wheelchairs for anyone who wanted them. They also provided a bus to bring everyone home. An official told the parents that their cars would be collected from the airport later that day. Sharon and Hood both helped Harley into a wheelchair. Alexander manfully took his place behind the chair as Sharon turned to her husband.
You're not coming with us, are you?
Her voice was flat and withdrawn, her eyes distant. He jerked a thumb toward the van.
I honestly didn't know they'd be here, Sharon. But I did kill someone on foreign soil. There's going to be fallout from that. But you'll be okay. Bob's arranged for round-the-clock police protection at the house. I wasn't worried.
Sharon turned toward the chair. Hood took her hand in his. She stopped.
Sharon, don't do this.
Do what?
Go home with our children? Don't shut me out. I'm not shutting you out, Paul. Just like you, I'm trying to stay calm and deal with things. What we decide over the next few days is going to affect our daughter for the rest of her life. But you've got two families again. I'm not going to waste any more energy fighting for equal time.
Hood was amazed.
Two families? Sharon, I didn't ask for this to happen. I was out of Op Center. If I'm back, it's because I'm in the middle of an international incident.
Just then, the State Department official came over. He told them the bus was loaded and waiting. Sharon told Alexander to go ahead. She said she'd be there in a moment. Hood gave his son a wink and told him to keep a careful eye on his sister. Alexander said he would. Hood looked back at his wife. Sharon was looking up at him. There were tears in her eyes.
And when this international incident is finished, will we have you then? Do you really think you'll be happy helping to manage a household instead of running a city or a government agency?
Hood answered honestly,
I don't know. Give me a chance to find out. A chance. Paul, this may not make any sense to you, but last night when I heard what you did for Harley, I was angry at you.
Angry? Why?
Because you risked your life, your reputation, your career, your freedom to save our daughter.
And that made you angry? I can't believe that.
It did. All I ever wanted from you were little bits of your life. Time for a violin recital, a soccer game, a vacation once in a while, dinner as a family, holidays with my parents. I rarely got any of that. I couldn't even get you to sit with me last night while our baby was in danger.
I was too busy trying to get her out.
I know, and you did. You showed me what you can do when you want to. When you want to.
Are you saying I didn't want to be with my family?
Sharon, you're stressed out.
Tears trickled down her cheeks.
I said you wouldn't understand. Paul, I'd better go.
No, wait, not like this.
Please, they're waiting.
Sharon withdrew her hand and ran toward the bus. Hood watched his wife go. After the accordion door was shut and the bus growled to life, Hood started walking toward Coffee and Herbert. Now Hood was angry. He couldn't believe it. Even his wife had found fault with what he'd done in the Security Council chamber. Maybe she and Chatterjee should hold a press conference. But the anger began to pass as Hood walked toward the van, and just as suddenly something else began to eat at him. It was a mixture of guilt and doubt, and it started bubbling up the moment Hood saw Bob Herbert stretch out his big, welcoming hand. The moment Hood realized that he no longer felt so alone. The moment Paul Hood had to ask himself the honest and very painful question, what if Sharon were right? The greetings were warm and the good wishes were sincere as Hood entered the van. There was no driver. After Herbert shut the door and Hood had settled into the passenger's seat, Coffee drove the short distance to Op Center. The attorney informed Hood that they'd only be at Op Center long enough for him to shower, shave, and put on a clean suit Herbert had brought from the house.
Why? Where are we going?
To the White House.
What's waiting for me there, Lowell?
I honestly don't know, Coffee admitted. Secretary General Chatterjee is flying down with Ambassador Meriwether to see President Lawrence. They're meeting at noon. The President is the one who wants you there.
Any idea why?
Coffee shook his head.
I can't imagine the president wants a he said, she said thing. He may want to send you back to New York in the custody of the American ambassador to make sure you're around to answer any questions the Secretary General and her associates may have, a gesture of our concern. Herbert's wheelchair was parked behind and between the seats. A gesture, he snorted. Paul saved the friggin' place. What he did took as much guts as I've ever seen. Mike and Brett were also great. But Paul, when I heard that you were the one who took the last guy out, I was never prouder of anyone. Never. Coffey nodded. But unfortunately, international law does not provide for proud as a defense. The president was ready to meet with the Secretary General of the United Nations as well as with Flora Merriweather, the U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., promptly at noon. He personally came out to welcome Mala Chatterjee. Michael Lawrence stood 6'4" with a close-cropped head of silvery gray hair and dark, sun-weathered skin. His smile was wide and genuine. It's good to see you again, Madam Secretary General.
Likewise, Mr. President, though I wish the circumstances were different.
The president's blue-gray eyes shifted to Ambassador Merriweather. Flora, would you mind giving us a few minutes?
Not at all.
While the president's executive secretary shut the door, the president showed Secretary General Chatterjee to a seat and said, I heard your remarks to the press. When you talked about the events that undermined the sovereignty of the United Nations, were you referring to the terrorist attack?
No, Mr. President. That is very much a separate issue. I was referring to the uninvited attack by Mr. Paul Hood of your National Crisis Management Center and two as yet unidentified members of the United States military.
You're referring to the attack that ended the hostage crisis.
The result is not the issue. At the moment, I am deeply concerned with the means.
I see. The president sat behind his desk. And what would you like to do about it?
I would like for Mr. Hood to return to New York and answer questions pertaining to the attack.
You want him to go right now, while his daughter's recovering from the attack?
He doesn't have to return immediately. The middle of the week would be acceptable.
I see. And these questions, what do you hope to accomplish?
I need to formally ascertain whether laws were broken and whether boundaries were overstepped.
Madam Secretary General, if I may, you're failing to see the larger picture here. I believe that the New York Police Department, the State Department, the FBI, and U.S. military units in the region acted with extraordinary restraint and respect, given how many young Americans were at risk. When the situation deteriorated and your own security forces were repulsed, yes, three of our people did go into the Security Council, but they did it selflessly and effectively, like U.S. soldiers have always done.
Their courage is not being questioned, but the law-abiding nature of the many does not outweigh the heroic lawlessness of the few. If laws were broken, then legal remedies may be required. This is not a whim on my part, Mr. President. This is our charter. This is our law. And there have already been demands that those laws be upheld.
Demands made by whom? By nations whose terrorists were killed in the attack? She shook her head.
By the civilized nations of the world.
And to satisfy their civilized bloodlust, you'll want to put Paul Hood on trial, the president said. Chatterjee gave a chilly smile.
Sarcasm noted. And yes, a trial is a possibility. Mr. Hood's actions demand it.
The president sat back. Madam Secretary General, last night, Paul Hood became a hero to me and about 250 million other Americans. There's no way on earth that man is going to stand trial for saving his daughter from a terrorist. Chatterjee regarded the president for a moment.
The United States will defy the will of the international community?
Openly and enthusiastically. And frankly, Madam Secretary General, I don't think the delegates to the United Nations will care for very long.
We are not the Congress, Mr. President. Don't misjudge our ability to remain focused.
Never, the president smiled. I'm sure the delegates will be very focused, trying to find suitable schools and apartments when this administration supports removing the United Nations from New York to another world capital, say,
Khartoum or Rangoon? Chatterjee felt herself flush. The bastard. The bullying bastard.
Mr. President, I do not respond to threats.
But you do. You just responded to that one, quickly and openly. It took her a moment to realize that he was right, and she listened carefully as he went on. No one likes to be pushed, and that's all we're doing here. What we need to do is to find a non-confrontational, non-threatening solution to this problem, one that's going to work better for everyone.
Such as?
As frustrated as Chatterjee was, she was still a diplomat. She would listen, and the president saw that. A more productive way of appeasing those irate delegates might be if the United States were to begin paying all of its $2 billion debt. The delegates would have more money for UN programs back home, such as the World Food Council, the Children's Fund, the Institute for Training and Research. And if we work this right, they'll feel as though they've won something. They will have won American capitulation on the debt issue. Your own status will not suffer. Chatterjee looked at him coldly.
Mr. President, I appreciate the thought you've put into this, but there are legal issues which cannot be dismissed.
The president smiled. Madam Secretary General, almost 25 years ago, a Russian, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, said something that these lawyers' ears never forgot. I have spent all my life under a communist regime, he said, and I will tell you that a society without any objective legal scale is a terrible one indeed. But a society with no other scale but the legal one is not quite worthy of man either. Chatterjee regarded the president carefully. This was the first time since she'd entered the Oval Office that she saw anything in his eyes, in his expression, that approached sincerity. Madam Secretary General, you're exhausted. May I make a suggestion? Why don't you go back to New York, rest, and think about what I've said? Think about how we can work together to establish new moral objectives. We need to heal the divide, not make it wider. Paul Hood waved to the press on his way into the White House, but declined to answer any questions. When he entered the Oval Office, the president offered his hand. Paul, it's good to see you. How's your daughter today? Hood looked quickly at Secretary General Chatterjee and Ambassador Meriwether, then said,
Pretty shaken up.
Understandably. Our prayers will be with you. If there's anything we can do, please ask.
Thank you, sir.
In fact, I think we've got things pretty well under control here. Why don't you go home to your daughter? We'll let you know if there's anything else. Though it would be a good idea if you stayed away from reporters for a few days. Let Op Center's press rep handle this. At least until the Secretary General has had a chance to talk to her people in New York. Hood shook the hands of the President and the Ambassador. Then he shook the hand of the Secretary General. It was the first time she looked at him since the night before. Her eyes were dark and tired. Her mouth was downturned, and there was gray in her hair he hadn't noticed before. She said nothing. She didn't have to. She hadn't won this battle either. Hood couldn't help but feel bad for Chatterjee. She wasn't a bad person. She wasn't even the wrong person for this job. The problem was the institution itself. Nations invaded other nations or committed genocide. Then the United Nations gave them a forum to explain their acts. Just allowing them to be heard had the effect of legitimizing the immoral. It occurred to Hood then that there might be a way for Op Center to help rectify those abuses, a way he could use the team's resources to identify international criminals and bring them to justice, not to trial, to justice, before they struck, if possible. It was something to think about, for though he owed his daughter a father, a family, he owed her something else as well, something very few people could hope to deliver, a saner world in which she could raise her own family. Los Angeles, California, Sunday, 3:11 p.m. He had been to many places in the world, the Arctic, the tropics. Each had their individual charms and beauty, but he had never been anywhere as instantly appealing as this place. He walked out of the terminal and sucked down the breezy, warm air.
The late afternoon sky was clear blue when he swore he could taste the ocean in it. He tucked his passport in his sports jacket and looked around. The courtesy buses were stopping along the curb, and he selected one that was going to a brand-name hotel. He didn't have a reservation, but when he went to the desk, he would tell the receptionist he did. He had forgotten the confirmation number. It was their job to remember, not his. Even if they couldn't accommodate him, they would scurry to find him someplace to stay. Brand-name hotels did that. He sat down in the tram and turned around to look out the window. There was rich greenery by the side of the road. The traffic moved swiftly, not like it did in New York and Paris. Ivan Georgiev was going to like it here. He would have liked South America, too, but things hadn't gone as planned. Sometimes they didn't, which was why, unlike the others, he had an escape route, and once he fought his way out of the hospital, he used it. If everything went wrong, Annabel Hampton was supposed to send her floaters to collect him. The plan was for him to meet her later at the hotel and arrange for her to be paid either from the ransom or from his own funds. When she didn't show, he assumed the worst. Later, when the floaters returned to put him on a plane and get him out of the country, he learned that she'd been taken. She would probably plea bargain her way to 15 years in prison by telling authorities about the CIA UNTAC link, they said, which was why he had to leave. The CIA planned to deny everything. Georgiev had money, and he had ideas. He also had connections with Eastern European expatriates, especially the Romanians, who had set up film companies in Hollywood. Georgiev smiled. His associates had told him that the film industry was a ruthless, sexy business, a business where a foreign accent was considered exotic and cultured and was a guaranteed invitation to parties, a business where people didn't stab you in the back in private. They stabbed you in the front, in public, where others could see. Georgiev smiled. He had the accent, and he would be happy to stab people wherever they chose. He was going to like it here. He was going to like it very, very much.
Clancy's Op Center State of Siege was written by Tom Clancy with Steve Pachenik and read by J.K. Simmons. It was abridged for audio by Leslie Thomas. It was recorded at Carnegie Hall Recording by Leszek Wojcik with editing by Rick Bradley. It was mixed by Hudson Sound. The production coordinator was Sally Hurst. Tom Clancy's Op Center State of Siege was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy's Every Man a Tiger with General Chuck Horner, read by Murphy Geyer. Into the Storm, A Study in Command, with General Fred Franks, Jr., read by Boyd Gaines and Ken Jenkins. Tom Clancy's Power Plays, Politica, with Martin Greenberg, read by J.O. Sanders.